Hello and welcome to the Tebby Podcast. I'm Robin Powell. This podcast is brought to you by Regis Media, which provides high-quality video content to financial advice and planning firms. Whether it's marketing or educational content you're looking for, get in touch with us via the website at regismedia.com. So, we live in interesting times, don't we? War in Ukraine, energy worries, inflation, and a possible global recession. There's certainly plenty of bad news around. And of course, stock markets around the world have fallen considerably, and there seems to be no end in sight to the current volatility. We wouldn't be human if headline anxiety didn't have an impact on us. Our guest today is Craig Lazara from S&P Dow Jones Indices. Craig is a managing director based at S&P's headquarters in New York City. Now, I'm not saying that Craig can alleviate any anxiety you might be feeling, but he can at least put all of this into some sort of perspective. Enjoy my interview with Craig Lazara. So, Craig, thank you very much for joining me. I suppose the question everybody's asking, and I don't expect you at all for one moment to provide an answer to it, is, you know, are we in a bear market? You know, are we at the start of a long market downturn?
Well, I'm glad you don't expect me to answer it, but I'll do my best. There is no official definition of a bear market. I mean, typically we say a bear market is a 20% decline and a correction is a 10% decline. And by that definition, we're clearly in correction territory for most major indices, certainly those here in the U.S. But short of Russia, there's nobody that I'm aware of that's in an actual bear market. Now, the better part of the question, I think, Robin, to give it the seriousness that it deserves, is where do we go from here? And I think what I would say in response to that is, it's impossible to know. I mean, it's not at all difficult to make up a list of, or to come up with a list, one doesn't have to make it up, unfortunately, of really unpleasant things that could happen over the course of the next several months. There could be a widening of the war in the Ukraine. There could be other commodity shocks. Who knows what China might do from a geopolitical standpoint. Ongoing high inflation and central bank policy. I mean, there's lots of things that one could cite as potential sources of harm. But I in thinking about this question, I mean, I think back to as recently as 2 years ago. I mean, to where were we? If we were recording 2 years ago this time, we would have said we're in the midst of a global pandemic. There's obviously a very serious disease out there. We don't know much at that point about where it came from, how virulent it might be, how far it might spread, what the ultimate fatality rate would be. In response to that uncertainty, as far as I'm aware, every major economy in the world voluntarily shut itself down. Not surprisingly, the markets fell very quickly. There was a huge response, obviously, the suppression of economic activity. So I recall the S&P 500 fell something like 37% in the space of not much more than a month. Between mid-February and mid-March, end of March 2020. And for calendar year 2020, the S&P 500 was up 18%. So it's hard to know. And when you're in the midst of it, as we are now, it's particularly hard to know because it feels very frightening because there's a lot of uncertainty and very often, historically, buying at times of great uncertainty over the long run are times of great opportunity. Certainly, that would have been the case 2 years ago.
Exactly. As you say, we are right in the eye of the storm at the moment. A pattern we're seeing, and of course, not unusual at all for periods of market volatility. We're typically seeing, you know, markets up 3% one day, down 3% the next, up 3% the next, and it's a real roller coaster like that. There was an interview with Gene Farmer in the New York Times the other day, in which he explained how, you know, there'd been this massive injection of uncertainty in the global markets, and investors are struggling to, you know, quantify that the risk, if you like, that poses to the global economy and the financial markets. Do you think that's fair?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you can almost measure it in some ways. If you look at the VIX index or other measures of volatility, and the VIX at the moment is in got a 32 handle. And you know, typically when VIX is above 30, I mean, what that basically is telling is you should expect, you know, 2 or 3% moves every day. That's the level of volatility that we have. And of course, the problem with volatility is, as Fama suggests, is you don't know how it's going to come out. I think one of the lessons of history is that for investors who have the luxury of doing nothing, this is not there's no necessary reason to panic. I'll cite Jason Zweig, wrote in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, was talking about, you know, the way investors feel about, and it isn't, I say feel, it is an emotional experience, the way investors feel about what's going on in the market. And he said, I'm not going to quote him exactly, it may seem like a disadvantage that in individual investors don't have forecasts and don't have opinions and don't have to react to what's going on. He said, that's not a disadvantage. That's a big advantage. If the history is very clear that even if you are making your very first investments, not from a long established portfolio, but if you're making a first investment at a period when volatility is elevated as it is now, that is not a bad entry point. You may have to be patient. It may take a year, 2 years, 3 years before you begin to see profits. But entering at a time of high volatility is not a bad thing, provided you have the wherewithal to ignore the volatility.
So, Craig, for many years you've run Spiva, which as most of our listeners will know is the S&P Index versus Active Scorecard. It's basically a scorecard of active fund managers around the world compared to, you know, the appropriate S&P index. I assume, Craig, it's too early for you to say, or whether you've got any clues at all as to how active managers have actually fared during this. Well, I suppose the volatility, in a sense, started in January, didn't it?
And then it certainly accelerated with the invasion. Quite honestly, no, you're right. I mean, we are just now beginning. I mean, literally, when I say just now, literally yesterday, as we record this. Spiva for Latin America came out for that's for calendar 2021 though. So, I mean, we're looking at historical results and I haven't looked through the results. They're about what you would expect. They're consistent with history. The history of this, obviously, Robin, you know, this is that the majority of active managers underperform, most of the time. Now the thing, and so to say what's going on now in 2022, how will that play out? I think there are both positives and negatives. The biggest positive for active managers is that there's a slightly, I should say it this way, active management tends to do slightly less bad. I won't say do slightly better, but slightly less badly in periods when the market declines, because active managers have the ability to raise cash. And obviously, if they do that in a timely way and the market goes down, that's a source of value added. So that now, whether as a group, they don't actually do it that well, but that is certainly a potential source of value added. So that's, you know, as we say, if we look for what the first part of 2022 is going to look like, that's something that might be on the side of at least some active managers. Contrary to that, one of the things that's very clear in the SPIVA data is that most active managers are underweight lower volatility, low beta names, and overweight higher volatility names. Because you see that because when our low volatility index underperforms, which is to say when the least volatile stocks are not doing well, when low volatility underperforms, that tends to be a relatively more favorable time for active management. And when low volatility outperforms, that tends to be a much more difficult time for active managers. And as you will not be surprised to learn, one of the best performing factor indices for the last month has been low volatility. I would speculate that this will not be a particularly favorable time for active managers. The other thing to say, I think, is one of the worst performing sectors over the last month or so has been technology, which has been the source of much outperformance for the past several years. So to the degree that managers were tilted in that direction, again, it will be a more difficult time going forward.
And on that subject, I get regular updates from our friend Larry Swedrow almost daily as to how Cathie Wood at ARK is doing. And the last missive I had from Larry was, you know, down, I think, 65% from the height 13 months ago, which means that she has to outperform. Or she has to produce returns of 265% just to recover the ground that she's lost in that time. And you do hear about a lot of technology managers who've got very unstuck, but I suppose in their defense, they run technology funds, you know, and they're going to pick technology stocks, and technology is going to come in and out of fashion.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true, and you know, I've met Cathie Wood. I don't know the fund. Well, I mean, I know what she does, obviously, but don't know the fund intimately well. But no, clearly, if you listen to what Cathie Wood says and you buy the fund, you know you're getting a tech fund. You know you're getting the disruptive, what she characterizes as disruptive technologies, and you should expect that to be a volatile ride. But when I say that technology has been particularly weak this year, I'm really referring more not to specialist technology funds, but to more general actively managed equity portfolios, where a source of value added for a good many years has been overweights in technology, and that's gone away. So unless a general active manager were very nimble at reducing his tech exposure this year, whatever helped him last year is hurting.
So how have the different segments of the market, if you like, responded so far to events in Ukraine? Clearly, Russian funds are in all sorts of trouble, many of them gated and so on, and investors can't get their money out. Sure. You mentioned tech and the tech bubble, the bursting, but in a sense that kind of predated Ukraine, didn't it?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah. So how have the different sections of the market, if you like, responded to this crisis?
Yeah, there have been some very wide swings, or as we would call it, very wide dispersion, whether you look at the factor level or at the sectoral level. So again, not shockingly, given what's happened, the S&P 500 the month of March to date, I think it's down 4.6%. Energy is up 9.7%. And by far the best performer, and not surprisingly, why oil prices are shooting upward every day. The weaker sectors have been technologies we've talked about, financials, and also consumer discretionary, and that again kind of makes sense. If there's going to be a general decline in economic activity, consumers will cut back on their discretionary purchases. But that spread within the space of really only a little more than a week in the month of March, as we record this, is just enormous. Mm-hmm. And if you look at factors as opposed to sectors, you get a kind of a similar look. I mentioned low volatility earlier. You know, the market's down 4.5%. Low vol for the month of March, at least through yesterday, was down about 0.6%. So, you know, good defensive sector. Dividend sensitive stocks are doing pretty well. Value is doing pretty well, and growth, which as you know is technology dominated, growth, momentum, high beta are all lagging quite substantially. So there's a very wide dispersion of returns. And coming back to a question you asked earlier, Robin, typically the very first paper we ever published to talk about market dispersion was called Dispersion : Measuring Market Opportunity. Dispersion is a measure of opportunity. And so when dispersion widens, other things equal, it means that active managers have the opportunity to create more value than they do when dispersion is narrow. The question is not, is the opportunity there? Because the opportunity clearly is. The question is, are they able to take advantage of it? And history says that by and large, they are not.
Mm. So we talking about history, we've got a major historical event on our hands. You know, the invasion of Ukraine is the biggest conventional attack in Europe since the Second World War.
Yes.
I think the last European war we had, I remember reporting on in Yugoslavia in the early 90s. I mean, let's hope that it doesn't get as sort of bloody and internecine as that. But you know, how have markets historically fared during wars? I mean, presumably not very well.
Well, it again, it depends on the time horizon. I mean, the mm-hmm. one, the no analogy is perfect, but I think back to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. The market declined for a while, and again we had a spike in the oil price for the obvious reason. Markets declined for a while, but ultimately finished upward. So the except for the countries directly involved, I mean, obviously Russia, which is under embargo from the rest of the world or sanctioned from the rest of the world, the stock market is suffering very badly and unsurprisingly. But for the countries which are not combatants, but which obviously are affected by conflicts, it's not clear that a war is always a signal to retreat. I mean, it comes back to the issue we were speaking about a moment ago in terms of volatility. There's a lot of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that said, uncertainty is not a signal to change your investment portfolio. Historically, those who have invested during periods of high volatility or high uncertainty have done well. It may feel frightening, and it may take longer than it would in other times. But the uncertainty in itself is not necessarily a sign of an oncoming bear market.
Mm. I see that Dimpson and Marsh and Staunton have just brought out their latest version of the global investment returns yearbook from Credit Suisse. And, you know, that their research clearly shows, as you say, that as long as you weren't Germany or Austria, I think I remember reading in that report that Austria was the worst performing market.
Yes, you're right.
Apart from Russia, of course, in the 20th century, you know, that as long as you weren't particularly one of the losers, if you like, that you didn't necessarily in the long term suffer. And as we all know, markets rebounded, and eventually in Japan, massively rebounded before falling falling again. So generally what you're saying, Craig, is, you know, investors, that the fact that it's a war, and obviously as long as it doesn't turn nuclear, obviously, it is not necessarily a nightmare outcome for their portfolios.
No, and it's I mean, I hate to say it, Robin, because it makes me sound very callous, because I can be very callous, of course, I know that. But I mean, it makes me sound callous. And we just abstracting from the moral issue, abstracting from, you know, the really inspirational bravery of the Ukrainians faced with this much, much larger foe. Abstracting from all that, unless the war gets much worse, if there's a wider land war in Europe, obviously that has implications beyond what we're seeing in Ukraine. And I don't mean to minimize the degree of disruption. I mean, particularly if Russian oil is sanctioned. And of course, President Biden announced yesterday, as we record this, that the U.S. would ban imports of Russian energy. Much harder for Europe to do that, of course. But particularly as it, to the degree that Russia is isolated from the world economy, that will be disruptive. It will be a source of volatility. It will be a source of perhaps economic recession in parts of Europe. And I don't mean to gainsay that, but I come back to what we said earlier. Look at history, and over time, markets tend to rise. The capitalist system tends to do well, and it highly volatile parts. I mean, highly volatile times are not a bad entry point. I mean, I think of something Warren Buffett's attributed to Buffett. I'm not sure it's an exact quotation, but you know, you should buy when others are fearful and sell when others are greedy. And here's a time when many people are fearful.
Exactly. It's been fascinating talking to you about the Ukraine situation and the impact on the markets. I just want to ask you about a couple of other things before you go.
Sure.
I know you've written recently about the value premium. Right. It's been quite sort of stop-start, hasn't it? But basically the value premium has reemerged, then sort of gone away again, and then come back again. Maybe you could just explain what's happened.
Sure. Sure. If you look at, I mean, it the exact analysis depends on how you define value and how you define growth. But if you take, you know, the way that we typically do it at S&P and split the S&P 500 into a value half and a growth half, what you see is there are long periods of time when growth outperforms, there are long periods of time when value outperforms. We're currently, as you say, in a period started last, I want to say December, when value has been doing much better than growth. If you look at the history of value and growth, at least again, as we measure it, the shortest period of value dominance has been 6 months. The longest was 4.5 years. So the fact that we're now maybe 4 or 5 months into a period of value outperformance does not tell you, well, it's, you know, if the longest historical period were 6 months and we're now at four, I'd say get ready to do something because it's almost over. But it's not. I mean, there have been periods, I think, from mid-2003, I think, until 2007, long run, when value did much better than growth. The other thing that analysis shows, if you do that, is, and because people have asked, well, it may be true that value does better than growth for a multi-year period, but it might also be the case that the majority of value's advantage occurs very early on, and after that, it sort of just trickles in. And it turns out to be the case that, in fact, the value premium accrues fairly steadily. So if it's not like in the 50-month period that we saw in 2007, it is not the case that most of the benefit occurred very early on. It occurred steadily over time. That's not in itself a forecast that values outperformance will continue. But certainly there's nothing in the history that would say, you know, because we've done well for the past, or value's done well for the past 4 or 5 months, that it's time to begin worrying that its run is almost over.
And the final question I want to ask you is about alternative investments. You know, we're seeing this massive push, aren't we, at the moment, particularly in the institutional space, but also, you know, to a lesser extent in the retail space as well. This push towards hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, and so on. Now, I know you guys at Spiva have been very much focused on, you know, the public securities markets, if you like. But what can you tell us about evidence as to, you know, whether or not these kind of investments have delivered decent returns in the past? I'm thinking, for example, of a study by Morningstar, which John Riekenthaler recently wrote about, which he actually showed that these alternative investments have been, I think the word he used was pretty useless at kind of hedging against market falls, certainly since 2007. And also haven't provided the diversification benefits that many people think they do. What's your own take on that?
What you just said, Robert, is very close to what I've garnered from my reading about the subject. I mean, you're right that what we do in Spiva relies on public markets because we need to have prices, one of the I would say drawbacks of alternative investments are they tend to be relatively obscure. Now, in some cases, that's necessary. I mean, if you're a venture capital fund and valuing a private company and there's no public market for the shares, there's a certain amount of flexibility in how the valuations are done, and we certainly can't observe that from a universe standpoint. I guess I would say I think there are two things that one might say, and I think the research on this is fairly conclusive. One is that the Morningstar study that you cited is correct that as a group. Alternative investments have done certainly after costs have done no better for investors than they could have done simply by investing in a well-diversified index of public securities. I think the second thing that's true is that there may be, at least in some alternative categories, kind of a hierarchy of managers, and there you can identify some who have done extremely well over time and really have provided value added to their clients. And what's typically true of those investors is that they won't take your money. They've already got as much to invest as they need. I mean, this is one of the advantages. Your listeners will have heard perhaps of the so-called Yale model pioneered by the late David Swensen. And clearly the case that the Yale endowment, Yale University endowment, did extremely well over many years, thanks in no small part to Swenson's abilities. And one of the things he did was very early on began to get to know venture capital firms, tried to figure out who the good ones were, because he realized there was a huge gap in performance. The asset class as a whole may not do much for you. The very best managers may be able to do a great deal for you. The problem is you need to devote someone with Swenson's abilities to figuring out who the best managers are, and then forging relationships with them so that they can accept your money, as they would do with Yale. But the from the standpoint of an individual investor, the likelihood of being able to do that analysis and finding a manager who wants additional assets. It's not worth the trouble. You're much better off just investing in, as I say, a broadly based index of public market securities, which over time has done as well as the alternative asset classes have done.
Indeed, we saw the SEC, didn't we, a few weeks ago, signal its intention to kind of step up kind of transparency, if you like, in the alternative investments space, particularly private equity. I mean, it's unlikely, of course, that we're ever going to get the kind of data that enables you to produce a table like Spiva, exactly. for example. But presumably, Craig, one day you and your colleagues will be able to sort of, we hope, study the performance of private equity funds and venture capital funds in a more meaningful way than you can at the moment.
Yeah, it would. We would love to be able to do it, because obviously people ask for this, clients ask for this all the time, and we'd love to be able to do it. The problem is simply the obscurity of the data. And the other part of the problem, I would say, is even when you have databases of alternative asset returns, they're typically self-reported, which means that if I'm a private equity manager and I have a particular fund that hasn't done very well, maybe I don't report it. With the benefit of Spiva, and the reason it has the reputation that it has is it's done on a database of mutual funds, which are required to report. And so you can adjust for survivorship effects and survivorship bias, which is very important. Any kind of investment analysis you do, obviously, if you're looking at returns, historical returns, you want to make sure they're adjusted for survivor bias. And Spiva is, it's not necessarily the case that data on alternative investments has that same property.
Mm. Craig, thank you so much for your time today. And look forward to catching up with you again, as this very interesting year that we've embarked on unfolds.
Thank you, Rob. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
And that's about it from this episode of the Tebby Podcast, brought to you by Regis Media. You've been listening to me, Robin Powell, interviewing Craig Lazara from S&P Dow Jones Indices. A big thank you to Craig for his time. I would also like to thank S&P Dow Jones Indices for its ongoing support of the evidence-based investor. Without the help of our strategic partners, we wouldn't be able to do the work we do. If you're interested in finding out how you too can partner with us, please do contact us via the Tebby website at evidenceinvestor.com. That's evidenceinvestor.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.